Hello, hello, and welcome to Arthouse Garage, the snob-free film podcast where we make arthouse, indie, classic, and foreign cinema accessible to the masses. I'm your host, Andrew Sweatman, and today we're continuing our marathon with Omaya Jones through the world of Wong Kar-wai with a look at 1994's Chungking Express. Plus, we've got a review of the new movie, Mogul Mowgli, as well as reactions to the recent Bentonville Film Festival. Don't go anywhere. I was very fortunate recently to attend the 7th annual Bentonville Film Festival. I did attend virtually, but I still had a great time with the film selections and the online discourse. The festival happens each year in Bentonville, Arkansas, and they really focus on diversity. My impression of the festival, since this was my first time going, was that they aren't just saying that. The diversity of voices behind and in front of the camera came through in nearly every film I watched. Women, people of color, people from the disabled community, and people from the LGBTQIA+ community were all over the films featured this year. What films did I watch? Quite a few, but as always, less than I wanted to. I had to attend virtually because of schedule conflicts, and that was also the reason I was fairly limited time-wise in what I was able to watch, but I did manage to see a lot. In all, I saw 2 features and something like 30 short films, quite a few. The 2 features I saw were Mogul Mowgli from director Bassam Tariq and star Riz Ahmed. More on that in a minute when I give my in-depth review. The other feature was called Coast from directors Jessica Hester and Derek Schweikart. Coast tells the story of a young woman named Abby. She's dissatisfied with her small town life and desperate to find a way out. She latches on to a musician named Dave, and for much of the film, Abby feels torn between her new friends and Dave's band and her old friends, and she kind of contemplates running away to travel with the band. Coast is a coming-of-age story that didn't have a lot of surprises for me in terms of plot, but I still found a lot to like with it, namely the performances and the focus on female friendships. The young actors are all really strong, in particular Mia Frampton as Christy and Kane Ricciotti as Dave, both of whom I found incredibly engaging on screen. And the relationships between Abby and her 2 best friends felt unique because they felt real, and you could almost feel the history between them, whether in moments of camaraderie or moments of conflict. On the short film side, a handful of titles really stuck out to me. One was a sort of horror comedy thriller called Boss Babes. This film is directed by Corey Clifford and Ryan Lagode, and it basically envisions a multi-level marketing company turned evil. It's a wonderful critique of capitalism in the digital age, and stylistically, it felt like Kill Bill meets the Neon Demon. Very funny and shocking, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. Another favorite was a short documentary from the LGBTQIA+ short block called In the Image of God, directed by Bianca Rondolino. It features a rabbi named Levi who was born intersex, as were some previous generations of his family. He tells his story and reflects on the ways that gender expectations have affected him and his life of faith. I found it incredibly interesting and really moving. And a final standout was a film called Girl Night Stand, Chapter 2. It's a very charming and well-acted short film from director and star Jenna Lorenzo. The film looks at the challenges of finding connection during a pandemic, so it feels very timely in that way. I immediately had to seek out Chapter 1 of Girl Night Stand, which was made before pandemic times, and I was pleased to find that actually both Chapter 1 and Chapter 2 are on YouTube. I also promptly added Jenna Lorenzo's feature film, which is called Les Bomb, to my watch list. Aside from films, one of the things I love about film festivals is meeting people, and it turns out I was still able to do that virtually. If you followed along on my Instagram for Arthouse Garage, I was posting a lot of the films I was watching and tagging the filmmakers when I could, and that actually led to some really great conversations and connections, and I may just get some podcast guests out of it. Stay tuned to future episodes for that. So that was my Bentonville experience. I know there was so much more offered that sadly I didn't have time for, both in terms of films as well as some of the really interesting panels they held, but I still thoroughly enjoyed the work I was able to take in, and I hope to be able to do even more in years to come. You can find out more about the festival at bentonvillefilm.org.
Yeah, we'll ask you where you're from. Now, where you really from? The question seems simple, but the answer's kind of long. Britons are on board, had another cup of tea in that. But where my jeans are from, people don't really emcee it now. Now everybody, everywhere, want their country back. If you want me back to where I'm from, I probably need a map. No man's land yet, between trenches, no weed grows there. But it's fertilized by the brown bodies that fall for Britain in the war, so when I spit a puppy grows there. I find my own place in this business of Britishness. So stop trying to find a box for us. I'll make my own approach and fucking consent of us. Motherfucker, my blood and sweat's in us.
That was the trailer for a film called Mogul Mowgli, which was my favorite thing I watched out of the Bentonville Film Festival. The film stars Riz Ahmed as a musician who suddenly loses the ability to perform, and it follows how he deals with that life-changing condition. If that sounds familiar at all, it's because that's nearly identical to the setup for the film Riz Ahmed starred in last year, which was called Sound of Metal, which was also my favorite movie last year. Apart from that premise, though, the films couldn't be more different. In Sound of Metal, Ahmed plays Ruben, a metal drummer who loses his hearing and ultimately finds meaning in a deaf community, and must come to terms with his hearing loss. Here in Mogul Mowgli, Ahmed plays a British rapper named Zed who has a complex relationship with his family and spends much of the film grappling with his Pakistani heritage. Zed suddenly develops a degenerative muscle disease and loses the use of his legs, facing surgery and many months of physical therapy to even begin to address the problems. This happens just before he's supposed to go on his first world tour, and it prevents him from what would have been his big break as a musician. Just like in Sound of Metal, Riz Ahmed's performance is amazing, though it feels much more personal in many ways because of the way this film focuses on cultural heritage, and musically it feels closer to reality because Riz Ahmed is a rapper himself. Another key difference is just how musical this film is. In Sound of Metal, there's a kind of an opening musical scene, but from there, the focus is on Ruben's experience. But in Mogul Mowgli, there are lots of scenes of Zed on stage performing. The lyrical content of his songs often pertains directly to his experience. It almost feels like reading his journal, kind of cut in between scenes of his day-to-day life and struggles. The direction by Bassam Tariq is very strong, but not what I expected. For one thing, the film is shot in a boxy 1.33:1 aspect ratio, which, combined with the relatively free-form camera work, gave the whole film the feeling of a home movie. There are also some unusual choices made. At a few points, we see video from Zed's cell phone as he's sharing on social media. At other times, we see things from Zed's perspective when he's having visions of people who aren't really there. So there's some really interesting things going on here. When this film is more widely available, I'm excited to read perspectives from people closer to Zed's experience. The film feels steeped in Pakistani culture and in the experiences of second-generation immigrants, and those aspects of the film really worked well for me, and I found them fascinating and educational, but I also feel ill-equipped to judge those things since that's so far outside of my experience. Director Bassam Tariq made some headlines recently when he was announced as the director for the upcoming Marvel movie, Blade. I'm fascinated to see how that turns out, especially having seen this, because I can't imagine a less Marvel-y film than Mogul Mowgli. It's always interesting to see how people work within well-established systems like the MCU. Aside from the performance from Riz Ahmed, the other actors in Mogul Mowgli are all really wonderful, especially Ali Khan, who plays Zed's father, Bashir. The father-son relationship ends up being a major part of this story, and both sides of that are incredibly well acted. That is Mogul Mowgli. It will open in limited release September 3rd, and I hope it goes wider after that, because it's really a wonderful film. And now it's time for Wong Kar-wai. We've been watching through the Criterion box set World of Wong Kar-wai with the help of Omaya Jones, who is back today to talk about a big one, Chungking Express. We talk all about the film, its creation, the history surrounding it, our reactions to it, and the thematic ties to Wong's other films. Welcome back to the show, Omaya Jones. How are you?
I'm doing good. How about you?
Doing very well. Yeah, it's a wild time. Summer's ending, school's starting, getting kids ready for school and figuring out what COVID's going to be like and all of that fun stuff. But amidst that, some good movie watching. So excited to talk about Chungking Express. But how have you been? What's up with you?
What is up with me? I'm working on some secret projects that I can't talk about a lot right now. That may be postponed because of COVID. So we'll see what happens as far as that goes. What else have I been up to lately? I mean, it was further back in the summer, but I recorded a play for a friend. And that aired on KBF, and I think it's online now somewhere on this website called the Ozark Living Newspaper. It was called A Honky Hymn. So that was a thing that happened earlier this summer, and that consumed a lot of my time. But other than that, things have been relatively quiet lately.
Interesting. I will try to, if that is online, I'd love to share that out, and I want to check that out myself. That sounds interesting. But yeah, it's kind of a weird time. If you're not in Arkansas, you might not know, but the Delta variant is really hitting Arkansas hard because we have so few vaccinated people. Go get your vaccines, everyone. Anyway, enough about that, but that's kind of what's going on here in this part of the country right now. But let's talk about Chungking Express. So this is the third film in our series and third film in the box. And I am a big fan of this movie. So this was released in 1994. A few basic facts about it. It stars Bridget Lin, Takeshi Kaneshiro, Tony Leung, Fei Wong, and some others. Those are the four main characters. It tells the story of two different policemen kind of going through heartbreak separately. It's two very different stories that are sort of barely joined together, which we kind of hinted at last time. And Days of Being Wild has a similar, just kind of unusual structure, different than the structure of this movie. But it's interesting to see how he plays with structure in different movies and in different ways. And I'm curious to see if that kind of continues on in these other films. But this was my second time to watch it. I appreciated it so much more this time, having, you know, read a little more about him and kind of understanding a little bit more of why he's such a significant filmmaker. And I liked it the first time. I loved it the second time, just here recently. What about you? How many times have you watched it, Omaya?
I think I watched it twice for this. So I think that makes it maybe four or four and a half, something like that. Nice. I think the first time I watched it was probably I was in college or something. Mm. And it was probably a disc that I got through Netflix DVD service, which I still have.
I've thought about doing it many times. I didn't know you had it.
Yeah, increasingly it makes less and less sense because there's more and more stuff that you look at. It's like, well, that's streaming on this service that I have access to, but I feel I don't want to give it up. And there are things on there that you can't get otherwise. But yeah, this time, I think this is the first time that after I saw it, I did a lot of research and reading about it. And so there were things that are sort of clarified that I don't need clarification to understand it. Like, for example, the geography. Getting that the title specifically references the stories of the film and things like that. It was a rewarding watch again to see it after, I don't know, 15 years or something.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I think the first time I watched it was like 2 or 3 years ago. So it hasn't been quite such a long break. But yeah, that is interesting. I think it does work on its own, but then there's so much Hong Kong stuff that just after watching it this time and researching that kind of really enriches that. And we'll talk about a lot of that, I'm sure. And just kind of how this movie was made and when it was made and how quickly and some of the things going on in the world. There's all kinds of things that kind of are extraneous that enrich it, I think, but it does stand alone too. Well, I thought we might give like a brief reaction, just a couple of things that we really like about it, and then we can talk about some of that context before we really dig into some of the details of the movie. So you go first. What, just a couple of things that really stood out to you this time around that you enjoyed about this movie?
The first thing I would say is definitely Tony Leung, just as a screen presence. Yes. Faye Wong, who is not, I mean, I've seen her in this, but I guess I was not aware of her status as a pop idol outside of this film. And then, let's see, the use of like genre as a jumping off point, right? So like we talked about this in As Tears Go By, how that is kind of like a crime film, and that is a genre that was very popular in Hong Kong at the time. But even in like Days of Being Wild, I've been doing some reading and just sort of like all of his films sort of use these genres that are popular in Chinese cinema and Chinese literature and use it as a jumping off point to do something different, right? So like in the first portion of the film, you get, it starts out as like this crime story, but that isn't so fully developed, right? It's more about these relationships. And then the second part is almost like a rom-com, but it's sort of, you know, I think it more closely fits the mold of a rom-com, but it still sort of explores different avenues.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And that, that's such an interesting thing about, like, because I think the first time I watched it, that was, that kind of threw me off, because it's like, oh, this is an action movie, right? And then it's not at all. and I was like, oh, it's like a Hong Kong, this must be like one of those Hong Kong action movies. So that kind of threw me for a loop. So maybe that was the difference this time too, was watching it kind of having a little more idea. And the first time I watched it, I felt like the music was repetitive, but this time I was like, oh, it's perfectly repetitive. Like it's exactly what it needs to be. Like, I think I was the first time around, like, okay, I've heard California Dreaming enough times. It plays it something like 9 times or something in the movie, which just sounds like an extreme amount for any movie, any song to play in any movie. But I think it really does work. But yeah, so this time around for me, yeah, just the narrative and like anticipating that it's the way it works, and like those moments where it freezes and it's like, this is the closest we ever got kind of thing. I really like that, and how it draws the two stories together. Yeah, what you mentioned, Faye Wong, it's just incredible. And I didn't know the first time either that she was a pop star, and I kind of learned that after watching it again this time too. And yeah, what an incredible screen presence. Tony Leung, so amazing. And then just all the Wong Kar-wai things, which we'll talk more about, but like the way the time and all the expiration date stuff, I thought that was all so interesting. And it all kind of, there's so many different threads, thematic threads all over this movie that connect to the two stories together, or connect to his other films in some ways too. So yeah, I really, really enjoyed it. So yeah, we can talk more in depth about all of those things in a minute here. Let's talk about the film, like as it is in his filmography, like where it is there, and kind of the history around it and stuff. So I wanted to talk a little bit about Ashes of Time. So that was actually the next movie he made after Days of Being Wild, or at least he had, and correct me if I'm wrong, but like they were done shooting it, but they were in post-production when they started making this movie. Is that right?
Yeah. So the production of Ashes of Time went on for something like 2 years. And then during the process of editing, I guess they had a break of a couple of months, and that it was in that space that they shot Chungking Express. And it uses a lot of the cast from Ashes of Time, because I guess they were just sort of around. And like Bridget Lin, who was in Ashes of Time, is also in Chungking Express, and this is her last film. And I think he like wanted to get back to something simpler and more experimental and less strenuous. And he talks about sort of like coming back to Hong Kong after shooting in the Chinese desert on Ashes of Time for so long, and sort of being invigorated and wanting to channel that into a project. And that was how Chungking Express was born. We've sort of talked before about his process, and it's interesting that like that his process didn't change here. He would still do this thing where you sort of start with a script or an idea. And he talks about how, you know, before he was a director, he was a script writer, and he would write these really detailed scripts. So once he became a director, he realized that so much happens on set and you get so much inspiration, so that his scripts become more sparse and more like outlines. And so they would do this thing where they would shoot, and then he would sort of watch the footage and then wait for inspiration to strike before sort of writing the next chapter, which is why some of the productions get so long. But then it's also curious because, you know, this was shot in like 6 weeks, and it actually came out before Ashes of Time by a couple of months.
Yeah, and it's so interesting because, like, yeah, learning that it was almost thrown together is not the right word, but it came together very quickly compared to Ashes of Time, and there's such like an improvisational nature that that you just talked about. But then one thing I learned was that this is in the commentary. We'll talk about all the different commentaries that are out there and all of that in a minute here. But the commentary that's on the Criterion Channel and on the standalone disc is a film critic. I'm blanking on the name. I'll find it in a second.
Tony Raines.
Tony Raines. There it is. And he just highlighted the fact that a lot of the places they shot this movie in Hong Kong, they didn't have permits, and so they were, you know, stealing the shots. They were just going around and making it, which kind of adds to the quick, free-spirited nature of this film production, I think, which is kind of cool. But yeah, so speaking about Hong Kong, like, there's so much Hong Kong stuff in this that, again, I didn't really know. But like the title of the movie, we can talk about that, and some of the geographical places that this film takes place. But yeah, you were talking about the sort of the geography of Hong Kong itself, and how it's almost two parts of the city. Is that right?
Right. So there's Hong Kong Island and Hong Kong Peninsula. Mm-hmm. And so the Chung Kee Mansions is in one location, and the setting for much of the second portion of the film is in an entirely different location that's separated by a bay. And apparently in the Chinese cut of the film, there's a scene where in the beginning, when you have the voiceover, which is sort of explaining the thing about the expiration dates of the pineapples, that is over footage of that character on a ferry, right? Mm-hmm. And so the geography is made much more plain in the Chinese cut than it is in the international version.
Yeah, go ahead.
So I just think, like, you know, going back to sort of the idea of the restorations in this box set in general, there's just like, I guess it's always been the case that there are many different cuts of these films. And so it's almost like it's just continuing a tradition. But yeah, it's like the world of like Chung Kee Mansions, which is, I guess, like these several, these different houses. They're like large, almost like multi-block shopping malls. They almost seem to me like, have you ever seen Judge Dredd?
I have not, no.
Okay, well, like in that world, it's like this feature, there are these mega cities that are just like these large skyscraper type things, and it's like an entire city, one thing. And it almost seems like that. And they're like three hostels, hotels, various shops and things that are in them, and it seems really chaotic and these Byzantine maze-like structures. And then on the other hand, across the bay is this diner called Midnight Express.
Midnight Express, yeah.
Right. Yeah, so like just playing with that geography and time and things.
So the title is kind of the combination of those two things in different parts of Hong Kong. Yeah, and so like the Chung Kee Mansions idea, like I haven't been there, but I mentioned in a previous episode, I spent some time living in China, and that kind of thing, it feels kind of familiar in a way. There's a lot of these kind of like a shopping mall, but it's really just a bunch of shops in a building. And you might have a hostel right next door to like a luggage purchasing shop, next to a t-shirt shop, next to like all these kind of things. But it doesn't feel exactly like a mall in the way that that we have here. So it kind of felt familiar, and there is sort of a chaotic feeling to it. And in one of those commentaries, I think, or in the commentary, or maybe in one of the interviews on the Wong Kar-wai set disc, that just talked about like Chung Kee Mansions in particular is like a hub, because there's a lot of foreigners there, and so like we have the people from India in this film, and that's like very much a part of the actual place, and just being like a kind of a melting pot and chaotic in that way. That and that's also where we get, you know, the motion blur shots and those kind of things in the movie, kind of adding to that sense of chaos. And then of course there's crime happening, there's shooting happening in the midst of it all, which even adding to it further. But yeah, there is a sort of a familiarity of some places I've been, but then the Midnight Express too, it's like a late night food shop. Like I think in England they call it like a takeaway shop. It's just like kind of junk food after you have been partying. You go get some, you know, pizza on the way home, kind of thing. So that's sort of the vibe that has. And anyway.
Yeah, but then there's also this other unique geographic feature, which is like the escalators.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Which like these central escalators that I guess go, they run for like a mile in length or something like that, or a mile or half a mile or something like that, and they reverse course at the end of the day. So it's like this congestion feature that's meant to like drive down the number of cars that people have to take. So there's just these escalators that take you from
foot. Yeah.
Right. And the escalators just take you from one portion of the city to the other. Like the residential area to the business district or something like that. And then at the end of the day, they reverse, so you can go back home.
And I believe they were pretty new when this was made. Like they had only been there for like a year or something like that. Maybe even less. And so what's interesting too, so the apartment that is Tony Leung's character, what, Cop 663, I think, that's actually Christopher Doyle's apartment. And maybe still he lives there, I think. And it's just right outside. It's like the relationship between the apartment windows and the elevator or escalator ends up being an interesting part of this movie too, because you can just kind of, you have to bend down on the escalator to see inside the window. But so that's an interesting thing. So there's the apartment. What other major locations am I forgetting here in the movie?
See, the apartment, the diner, Chunky Mansions. I think there's a bar, right? The bottoms up the bar.
Yeah.
Right.
Which is a real place too. Yes. But they apparently changed the inside a bit for the movie or something.
And then, you know, we spend a little bit of time in the airport. The airport is like a recurring theme in both stories, right? It's a location that kind of comes up in both. But I think that's sort of it for the location.
That in particular, the airport is a place where you're really not allowed to film a movie. Like, yeah. It's very, like they stop you. And so those are all stolen shots in the airport there. So we mentioned, let's talk about some of the actors one other thing about just Hong Kong in general is sort of the historical moment. This is something again that was lost on me the first time I watched it, but so this came out in 1994. So just a few years before, Hong Kong was, came back under the Chinese government's control.
Yes. Handed over by Britain to China. Yeah.
And so there was apparently there was a real sense there of people wanting to leave, and that the way that was told in this commentary anyway is that a lot of people really did consider leaving, and that kind of plays into the story of this longing for California, and Fei Wong eventually does leave for California, and so there's that kind of tapped into a zeitgeist in a way, perhaps, that people in this location at this time had a certain longing to maybe not be there anymore. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah. There's also like, there's the way that, the way he produces these movies though, is like the characters are also sort of based off the actors who are playing them. Mm. And so it apparently was the case that Fei Wong, before she was in this film, she had just released an album, but before that she had gone to New York to find herself. And so there's this, element of what is potentially that fact is sort of potentially imbued into this character, someone who is longing to go somewhere to figure out who they are, on this quest of self-discovery or something.
Yeah. And so let's talk about Fei Wong in particular. So yeah, as a pop star, she was her first time acting. And I read a really interesting article on the Criterion website that I'll link to that was comparing this movie to Jean-Luc Godard's Masculine Feminine. Which also features a pop star. I have not seen it, so
The Amy Talbin piece.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, I'll find that and put the link in there. But yeah, just how both of those films have a pop star singing their own song in a certain moment in the film. And we'll talk about all the music in this movie. But one of the songs is a Fei Wong version of another song, and she sings along to herself in the movie, which is kind of a fun little thing. But yeah, she apparently. Yeah, as a first-time actor, was a bit uncomfortable at first with dialogue and different things, and that's part of the reason why there's so many shots of her with other people. Like, she's kind of in the background in several shots at the beginning of when she's introduced, and she kind of had to take some time to get comfortable on set. But she ends up being pretty much my favorite thing in the movie. I think she's amazing in every scene. All the scenes where she's in his apartment are just electric, and like she's really an amazing screen presence, and I'm really excited to see her in further movies. So I know she's at least in one others in the set. Yeah, Fei Wong is really incredible. Any other thoughts on her?
Yeah, there. Just like to put it in context, this is from an Oliver Wang piece that's also on the Criterion's website. But it says, to put her casting in contemporary terms, imagine a promising but still unproven art house filmmaker convincing Ariana Grande to star in a low budget indie film that happened to come out weeks after the release of her chart topping Thank You Next. For Wong Kar-wai, Chungking Express was a breakout international hit, but for Fei Wong, it was one highlight in an already meteoric career.
Wow.
Yeah. And I think like what she does so well is just acting with her body. You know, it's her movements and it's her facial expressions, and it's all of this nonverbal communication that she does really well.
And she's not the only pop star in this movie, right? The other the policeman from the first half, Takeshi Kaneshiro, also a musician and also actually knows what, 5 languages. And that's, so speaking of how the, some of their character traits are written into the movie, that plays into his character quite a bit. But he, maybe not as famous as Fei Wong, true, or do you know?
I don't know. You know, he's in, so he comes back in Fallen Angels. He's in House of Flying Daggers. I don't know much about him in terms of a career as a pop star. But yeah, he's half Taiwanese, half Japanese. And that comes up in the film because, like, I guess the voiceover is in Cantonese, I think, or Mandarin. And then his spoken dialogue is in the other dialect.
Yeah. And then he has a moment when he talks to Bridget Lin's character. And he asked her the same question. I think it's about pineapple or something. But he asked in several different languages until she understands. Yeah. It's kind of a funny little thing. Speaking of Bridget Lin, so as you mentioned, this is her last film, but she was in a lot of stuff before this. But she was kind of on the edge, ready to retire. And actually, Ashes of Time, maybe what she intended to do last, but then he kind of talked her into being in this one. But yeah, I haven't seen her in anything else, but I need to go look into her filmography and things, but she's an interesting figure.
Yeah. But and this brings up something that I think, is interesting just in that, like, when you shoot the way that he does, you produce so much footage. And, I know we're going to talk about the special features later, but like, it seems like on all of these movies, there's like you could do a whole different cut or a whole nother movie. And I wish that he would, because there's lots of footage that looks really interesting that I want to see, that's cut from all of these. So like with the Bridget Lin character, like the original story was that, the original first story was going to be more in depth in terms of, I guess, the crime, and there's more intrigue, and all of that gets cut. But like one of the things that we see in some of the cut footage is that a lot of that was shot, you know, it exists, or at least existed. Who knows how well it's been taken care of. I want to see it all.
Yeah, we'll talk about there's a deleted scene that kind of focuses on her, and it's really odd and kind of changes the whole story of the movie or quite a bit, unless I'm understanding it wrong. But yeah, she's kind of mysterious. She wears this blonde wig, and it's a kind of an iconic look. And I think probably with a character like this, she's kind of mysterious, and I think maybe that's to her credit. So the more you know, maybe the power's taken away a little bit. That was kind of my sense with that deleted scene anyway. Anyway, we'll talk about that again in a minute. Yeah. But then the final of the four leads here is Tony Leung, who is so amazing in this. And I was watching, and there's a moment where he, I think it's the first time she comes to, I know it's probably the second or third time when she comes and he's having lunch and this open air market. And she's basically saying, like, checking to see, make sure he's not home so she can go break into his house. And, she just like brings him some fruit of some kind. And they have like a really brief conversation, like, why'd you bring me these? And she's like, has some little quip, but like, as she walks away, he makes his incredible face, like where he like looks at her, like, and you sort of like see some affection there and some puzzle, like he's puzzled by her, but also like clearly seems to like her. And that reminded me, he's like, oh yeah, I was listening to a podcast recently and some critics were talking about this movie, and one of them just went crazy about his face. And they were specifically talking about the ending. It was actually Slash Film podcast, and it was Hui Tran Bui is a critic I like a lot, but she was talking about his kind of crooked smile in the end of this movie and how just incredible of an actor he is, and what a face he has. And just his presence in general, like the first shot of him is just like him walking into the frame and it's this close up on him in the shop, and yeah, he's amazing.
Yeah, I love, he has this ability to convey so much by doing very little and sometimes nothing. Like it's just, it's like a style of like repression and sort of all this internal things that are going on. And he's just like, not, most actors can't do that. I don't think most actors can do as much as he does with so little, showing so little emotion and movement, and such subtlety.
Yeah, and I'm sure that's going to come back when we talk about In the Mood for Love, because he's one of the leads there, and I know that there's a lot of unspoken feelings in that movie, from what I understand. So I'm excited to see him in that. But yes, Tony Leung was one of the big revelations for me watching this the second time. I was like, wow, this guy's really amazing. Well, let's talk about what's in the Criterion set and maybe what's not in it and what's on the different editions. But if you put in the disc from World of Wonka Wai set, there's deleted scenes. There's three there, which we can talk about. There's a British TV show called Moving Pictures that has the interview with Wong Kar-wai and Christopher Doyle. And there's a separate interview with just Christopher Doyle going around to different locations in the movie. Some of the deleted scenes first. So yeah, we kind of mentioned the one with Bridget Lin. And so it's, there's like a little bit of interview with Wong Kar-wai, and then it kind of cuts into some of the deleted footage. But yeah, this first one is called The Star. And so it seems to show, what's the first cop's number? I'm trying to remember.
Takeshi, like 223 or 233.
Yes, that's right. It seems to change the story, at least in my understanding, that he's trying to, Bridget Lin in the film would have played a retired actress, in this different version, I guess, or maybe there's something they changed and ended up cutting and adjusting the story, but. And then he sort of has to get her involved in some sort of criminal activity. Did you understand that better than me?
I don't think I did. Like, I know, I guess like part of how he convinced her to make this as her final film was telling her it would be like some sort of like Streetcar Named Desire type thing. And her character would be like Blanche DuBois. But of course, in the process of making it, all of that was completely changed. And I guess the only thing that remained was the blonde wig and I think it was on the Tony Raines commentary. He talks about how like she has spent a bunch of time practicing like a Southern accent, all of this stuff just never manifests in the film at all.
Yeah, because what we get with her character is so different than what this shows. But I guess this gives us a little hint of what that would have been like. He's sort of obsessed with her as an actor, so that like none of that is in the final cut of the movie. But so that's The Star. The second one is called California Dreaming. At least that's the name on the disc there. And it mostly shows some cut footage of Fei Wong like dancing, being funny at work, talking to her coworkers. It doesn't add a ton, as I recall. But then what's interesting about it to me was that Wong Kar-wai talks about just her as an actor and working with her. And he talks about Tony Leung and how he kind of learned all these different techniques, but they were all useless when he was acting with Fei Wong because she's just sort of outside the box in a way that he kind of had to relearn what he was doing. Anything else from that scene?
No, I think I'm trying to remember if some of the scene, I know it's deleted, but I'm trying to like one of the iconic images that you see from Dragon Express is her on the escalator with like a bowl, like a ramen bowl. I'm trying to remember if that was in this and if that's actually cut from the film or not.
I think you're right about that. I'm not 100%, but I'm pretty sure that is in there. And I think when I was just looking at film stills from this at some point, there's that image is there. And I was like, I don't remember that being in the movie, but I think this must be where we see that. And that's like a cut scene. Because we see her on the escalator, not a lot. And we see her eating ramen in the apartment, but not, I don't recall her eating on the escalator. The third one is called Baroque, and it's mostly about the music and that electronic violin piece that plays so much in the first section of the movie. And it tells like how he went and got some of the music for this, which was that was really interesting to me. Like thinking about filmmaking at this time, like he went to a music shop and like found Indian style music to play in the parts of the movie that had these Indian characters. Like he literally just went and found a cassette and was like, oh, I like this, I'll use this. And like that's how he did his musical research. I thought that was so interesting. And it was in Chungking Mansions, this music shop. So it shows him going there and talking to the people, and they like seem to know him and stuff. So there's that. And I think it just kind of talks a bit more about music, and it's kind of more behind the scenes stuff actually than.
Yeah. I think, it also shows a lot of where they would be filming and then get cut off, right? Like,
oh, yeah, it does show them get chased off, yeah, which is funny. And, yeah, it's amazing to think like that. Those were the circumstances under which this, one of the, you know, most significant films in the last 100 years or something, those are the circumstances under which it was made. So that is the deleted scenes. Yes, there's then the TV program Moving Pictures, which is interesting. So it has Wong Kar-wai and Christopher Doyle, and they go to several of the locations, including Chungking Mansions. There's nothing. I think probably I had already listened to most of the commentary at this point, so I knew most of the stuff that they were going to say. But it was still really interesting to see them interact and kind of going around Hong Kong talking about that. And then also the interview with Christopher Doyle, where it's just him. In both of those, you can tell he's really quite an interesting character. You kind of said that when we had an interview with him on a previous disc, but in this one you see him, he seems like he maybe is drunk. I'm not sure.
Is
that just how he is?
He was enjoying life. He was enjoying life.
We'll very much enjoying life. Like, he starts hitting on some women at the club, it seems like. But they go to all these locations. They go to the club. They go to the escalator. He like lays down on the escalator and like they interview him laying down, going up the escalator, which is funny. They go to the Midnight Express, which has been kind of renovated and looks more modern now, I guess, but it's still there in the same location, it seems like. And it does it seem like the people that work there, like some of them were in the film, or at least they seem to still know Wong Kar-wai, and like they were there back then too. Am I making that up, or is that there?
I think you could read it. You could read it that way. It's not clear to me. So like, it's this camera crew following around a drunk guy who's not, you know, native there. He's Australian, he kind of sticks out. And so it's hard to tell to what extent everyone's just kind of going along with it and how aware they are.
That's true. Yeah. But then they also go to his apartment, which again, that's Tony Leung's apartment in the film. And they talk about, you know, how they flooded his place and they broke his fax machine and all these things that were frustrating to him. But I thought it was so fascinating to hear that he actually lives there. And I think it was actually in the commentary that Tony Rain, is that right? I'm forgetting his name again. He apparently stayed there with him at some point. Like, what's interesting about that commentary, let's talk about the commentary really quick, because that's the next thing I wanted to mention. It's not in the Wong Kar-wai set, but it is on the Wong Kar-wai standalone, or the Chungking Express standalone disc, right, which came out, what, like 15, 20 years ago or something like that.
Right, right.
But it's also on Criterion Channel. So if you don't have that or don't want to go buy it, you can stream it there, which is actually what I ended up doing. I had already watched it yesterday. Like, I'd watched the film the day before. And I was like, I'm doing the dishes and stuff. I was like, I really like to watch this with the commentary. So I put it on my phone and just kind of mostly listened to it and looked over here and there. And it's also showing the, I think the theatrical cut, or the cut that's on that disc of the movie, which is different than, slightly different than what we have in the set. So we'll talk about that in a second. But the commentary is really interesting because Tony Rain clearly like knows Christopher Doyle really well, and well enough that he stayed with him in this apartment. And knows Wong Kar-wai well as well. But he talked about when he stayed there, it's like become a tourist attraction almost, that a lot of Japanese nationals will come and they're doing like a Chungking Express tour, and they'll knock on the door and ask for a photo and that sort of thing. So it's so interesting that it's like a modern history thing that's still there.
It doesn't seem like that different from if you go to Hollywood or something and you buy like a Map to the Stars or like a star tour or something, except that I guess the security is much less lax. But then again, you know, Christopher Doyle is not like a major pop star or anything. Right. He's just a cinematographer, and it's a location that was in a film. So I guess it's not clear to what extent you would have beefed up security, I guess. Well, I was going to say a closer American equivalent would be like people who take a trip to the Twin Peaks Diner or something.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, that's probably a good call. Yeah, it's not like you're crashing Tom Cruise's house or something. It's just this guy. And he said in the commentary that some of the people that have come to Christopher Doyle's apartment, like Christopher Doyle has gotten work from those people. So like, it's like a networking thing too, which is kind of funny. So that was really interesting. But yeah, the commentary has lots of good stuff in it. So I do recommend watching it with that if you are so inclined. I think I didn't like take notes during it, because I was like I don't have the time for that, but I there are things that I'm sure as we're talking through the movie in a minute that will pop up from that, because it's really full of good information. Well, let's talk about the color changing and some of the controversy there. So this restoration was done in the last few years for this set, and there are some changes. Can you tell us about those, Amaya?
Right. So, you know, when they announced this and when screenshots were first circulating on the internet about the restoration, and maybe we can also talk about sort of like the word restoration and whether or not we should use that word, because it's unclear to me. All of this is very fuzzy to me. But yeah, the green tinting showed up. And yeah. I will say that upon watching the disc that's in the Order One Kawhi set, I did not notice as I was watching anything out of the ordinary. I know that like there are locations in which there is a green light on set, like diner locations or neon lights or something. Mm-hmm. And so maybe it's more apparent in those scenes, but it seems to fit. It's also sort of like not clear like to what extent they were like that initially. So this is a film that has had many different releases. It was first released in the US shortly after its Chinese premiere. I guess like in 1994, 1996, Quentin Tarantino saw it and he got the Weinsteins to buy it for him. And he started this this imprint at Miramax called Rolling Thunder Films or something like that. Yeah. And so they released it in like 94, 96 under that banner. But I feel like the version most people are used to is the Criterion version, which itself has changes from the version that was released, the Tarantino version. So color aside, you know, like there's the line that the first character 223 has his voicemail password, and the Criterion release, the single disc version, his voicemail password is "I will love you for 10,000 years." But in this restoration and on the Criterion channel, they have like a 1994, I guess the theatrical version.
Yeah.
And both of those, it says Undying Love. So that was like actually a change where it was changed back to what it was in a previous version. I've read people who say that they saw it at its initial premiere in 1994, that California Dreamin' is over the Cranberries Dreams cover is over the sipping coffee scene that lasts for like 17 or 22 seconds or something. But in the 2008 Criterion release, it's the sound of an airplane. So I feel like these things are like always in flux, and it's not always clear when you say you want something to be the way it was before, like what version are you referring to? And then like, I think like the color restoration or like the 2008 release was not overseen by Wong Kar-wai or Christopher Doyle. It might've been overseen by Andy Lau, is it Andy or Andrew? I guess Andrew.
Yeah, I think Andrew. Yeah. Either way.
Yeah. So he shot the first story, and the second story was shot by Christopher Doyle. So, you know, there are different versions and there are changes, but it's not always clear.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So when I watched through, so I listened to the commentary version, which on the Criterion channel, there's you can click on it, just play the movie. And then there's alternate version, which says is the 1994 theatrical version. And it says that is the one that is supervised by Christopher Doyle. And that, I believe, must be the same thing that's on the standalone disc, because there's also a little anecdote on the Criterion blog about the release of that disc and how they basically had it almost wrapped and they couldn't get a hold of Christopher Doyle. And then the last minute he contacted them, and then he did have changes and they had to like basically redo the whole thing. So that must be that version. But then there's also the Chungking Express commentary. You can just click on it. It's basically just the movie with an audio track. But I believe it did say the 10,000 years translation on the voicemail in that one, which I was just like had it on my phone and I was listening to it, but looking over. But
I guess technically, so getting ready for this, I watched the version on the disc, and then I think I did end up watching the 1994 version
through on the channel.
Did I watch this three times in the last week? I don't know.
Sounds like you did. But yeah, so I wonder if like that quote unquote alternate version is different than the commentary version on the channel. I don't know.
It is different. Like the time is different.
You can tell. Oh,
right. The length of the film is different. So yeah, there are three versions on the Criterion channel, one of which has the commentary track over it. But so yeah, I'm halfway tempted.
Put them all three on at a screen. I'm
halfway tempted to buy like the Rolling Thunder DVD release to compare it. Because it also has like this intro and by Tarantino, and after the film, giving him some context. You can find that on YouTube. It's not anything. There's no information that I don't think is on the commentary or any of the supplemental features on the disc or anything. Oh, there was another difference. Hold on. Let me, I have this. This is in a book here.
What book is this?
It's a book called, it's from this, the World Director series. It's by Stephen Tao. And it's just, I think it's, the title is just Wonka Why. And it has like 10 to 15 page essays on each of the movies up through 2046, I think. Because, yeah, I think it omits the Grandmaster. Yeah, I had two portions that I had highlighted. One, so on the inspiration for the film, like we mentioned before, that his chief inspiration are not necessarily other films, but literary, specifically the Argentinian writer Manuel Puig, who we'll probably talk about when we do Happy Together, because that was initially conceived as an adaptation of one of his novels. So I won't talk about him, but it says Juan's chief inspiration for Chungking Express was a short story entitled On Seeing the 100% Perfect Girl One Beautiful April Morning by the Japanese novelist Haruki Murakami. I don't think it's necessarily to go into the whole backstory here, but I think that's interesting.
Yeah. And the commentary too also talks a lot about his kind of literary inspirations. And that was something I wasn't always following 100%. Like if I would like go down and write down the names of these writers, but it is just interesting to note that Wong Kar-wai, and this is something also from the commentary, that he doesn't watch a lot of films while he's making a film, but he does read a lot. And he, like a lot of that comes directly into the writing process, I guess, because he's, you know, quote unquote, improvising or writing this as they go to some degree. Those things do come in a lot
here. So this passage just talks about some of the different cut or the difference between the international and the Chinese version of the film. But it says, however, the international version of the film differs to the one shown in Hong Kong. Chungking Express was the first of Wong's films to be distributed internationally, having captivated Quentin Tarantino, whose company Rolling Thunder brought the international distribution rights. The worldwide version is longer and contains more scenes of Chungking Mansion, of Bridget Lin setting up her drug deal with a group of Indians, accompanied by the soundtrack with a typical Bollywood song and fragments of dialogue that must be a Bollywood movie. Later, when Lin is betrayed, there is an extended scene in which she kidnaps a young girl in order to extract information from her father on the whereabouts of her would-be traffickers. A few scenes are reordered and trimmed from the Hong Kong version. Yeah, it also talks how it abstracts time and space by removing the scene of 223 on the ferry. So, yeah, I guess we talked about it. So I don't know how necessary that was to add, but yeah.
No, that's interesting. And there was, I think that was also in the commentary, that there's a cut that does not have the kidnapping scene, because that was just maybe a little too intense.
Well, I guess I wonder if that was just added for international audiences or not. It seems, I don't want to say it's like market research, but certainly like things are fine-tuned. I think he also tells a story on the commentary of the premiere. The late night premiere, and sort of like them refusing to start it until they had more reels of the film, because they were, I guess, editing up to the last minute. And so the idea that when a film premieres, that's the final version, I think it's never been true. You know, you even hear about people getting films ready to premiere at like Cannes, knowing that they're going to go back and continue to work on it after the fact.
Yeah, that's interesting. And yet I think like what we're talking about is markedly different than, you know, what people talk about with, you know, Disney editing things on Disney Plus and that kind of stuff. And that kind of gets more into the digital versus physical media argument. But I feel much happier having Wong Kar-wai sit down with Criterion and like be intentional about what he's giving us on a disc than, you know, corporate Disney changing Star Wars for the 10th time, you know. So I feel like there are two different worlds. I've seen people compare that, and we talked about that a little bit in previous episodes. But with all this, I think it's really interesting to talk about the different versions. And I'm not mad about any of them, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. Like Wong Kar-wai had a big hand in giving us what he gave us on this box set, and so I'm happy with it, and I'm happy to learn about other things, but I'm not gonna be mad about anything.
I think that kind of sums up the changes.
Yeah, and I'll see if I can find there's those side-by-side comparison blog posts out there. I'm sure there's one for this. I haven't looked at it actually, but as I was watching through it on the disc, I did note, so like I watched it on the channel the first time I watched it a few years back, and this time, the main thing I noticed is like this Blu-ray quality looks nice and crisp and looks really nice. Like I could tell a difference in that sense. As far as the color and things, not something I registered as I was watching, but
do you think people care about this, why that is?
Maybe. Let's do it.
Okay. I don't have a lot of this. I don't have this necessarily saved to memory, but the short version is, even if you're watching something that says it's streaming in 4K, so I don't think Criterion. Right. Yeah, I don't think Criterion promises 4K streaming, but Netflix does. But just like the bit rate from a physical disc, it's just higher. It's like 3 or 4 times higher than it is from any streaming service. So you do get more information, more details from a physical DVD or Blu-ray than you would from a streamer in almost any instance.
Yeah, absolutely. And see, that's something I've kind of learned over the last year. I bought a 4K TV last year during the pandemic as like I'm going to begin watching a lot of stuff. I'm going to invest a little bit in this. And then just recently, I went ahead and got a 4K disc player, anticipating the announcement that we got the other day with Criterion finally doing some 4K stuff. And then just in general, the quality of things. So that is a question I have, actually. So like, when you read on the back of a Criterion box, often it says, okay, this was put together from a 4K restoration, or I'm not saying that right, but
4K scan.
Yes, yeah, a 4K scan. Yeah. But they're putting it onto a Blu-ray disc, which obviously is not getting you that full quality. But this may be a question for any listeners who happen to know, a regular Blu-ray player versus a 4K Blu-ray player, is that going to have a better quality, or like read the image better than a standard Blu-ray player would have? Do you know the answer to that?
Well, I know like a lot of players have upscaling, you know, like they essentially, it's like an algorithm that sort of like tries to insert missing information or whatever. Right. And so I will notice like an improvement on my Blu-ray player. If I put it in a DVD, it looks better than it would in a standard DVD player. The other thing you have to consider though, is even if they do a 4K scan of the original film negative, it's about the workflow, right? So if they do a 4K scan, and so you can always go back and reference that 4K scan, or if you're going to do a 4K release later, you can always, you have it, you don't have to go back and rescan it. But if you know you're going to release it in 2K, then all the restoration work, if it's done digitally, might be done in 2K as opposed to 4K. Mm-hmm. And then you get into this other thing with like, I don't know if I bought it. I know I bought like the black and chrome edition of Mad Max Fury Road. Mm-hmm. But like, you have this thing with films that are shot digitally on cameras that are not 4K cameras, but then they'll be released in home video in 4K versions. And I don't know how you do that. So you have to like sort of get into like, okay, what is film? What is film capture? How does that information work? Yeah. Okay. And then like with digital, why you can't shoot something digitally 2K and then just say it's 4K. It doesn't work that way. You can't create information that's not there. And also like, I know with like Mad Max Fury Road specifically, they use a number of cameras, some of which were not even, I don't think 1080.
Interesting.
And so like with that 4K scan, like our 4K version of that, what are you really getting? Is it really 4K? It doesn't make any sense. But that, I don't know. I feel like there are people who can sort of recite to you the numbers off the top of their head in terms of like the pixel depth and stuff. Mm-hmm. And like you should, I would say, listen to some of those people. One of the podcasts that I started listening to, it's called Film Formally, and they have some episodes where they really go into that kind of stuff. And so there are episodes of that that I would recommend if you like really want an in-depth discussion on that.
Yeah, I texted a friend, hey, I bought this 4K player, just to tell them about it. And they said, oh, because I said, I don't have very many 4K movies yet. And they said, oh, but your criterions that are scanned in 4K will look better. And I was like, is that true? I didn't know that. So I don't know. I guess I still am questioning that, and I'll do some more research. But anyway, it looked really great on the 4K player. I watched Chunky Express on it, and it was good. Actually, first thing I watched on it was funny. I watched a standard DVD on my 4K player of The Pagemaster, that kids movie. Have you seen that before?
No. Well, maybe. I really like a 90s movie?
I watch it with my kids. Yeah, it's 90s. Got Macaulay Culkin, and he gets sucked into the books in a library.
Did it look better? Did you think?
It didn't look great, but maybe a little better.
I assume it does some sort of upscaling, right?
Yeah, it does to some degree.
Did you see a bunch of like artifacts or anything from that?
There was actually, like, I'm thinking this must have been like really poorly transferred from VHS to DVD at some point, and they just sold it because it, like, it had a green line on the whole film on the side of the screen. I'm like, this does not look great. I mean, I loved the movie. It's a movie that I really loved as a kid, and I finally showed it to my kids, and they seemed to enjoy it. So anyway, I'm a big fan of the Pagemaster. But yeah,
I would say, like, as an aside, just like, it's interesting to learn about the documentary space specifically. So like, when you know, if you're making a documentary, you're probably thinking in the back of your head, like, where is this going to go? You're going to sell it to Netflix or HBO. Right. And Netflix mandates a 4K workflow from start to finish. So have you heard about this?
No.
There's like a list of Netflix approved digital cameras, and they have to be 4K, and they have to meet technical specifications. And then your entire workflows, so from like editing, output, all of that also has to be in 4K for Netflix. And it's unclear to what extent this is like to like maybe head off potential lawsuits. You know, if you say something is streaming in 4K and then somebody looks and they see that it was actually shot on a camera that shoots native like 3.2. And so then you could say like, that's not really 4K. But yeah, like it's dictating sort of to an industry, like, this is how you must do this. And I think documentaries in particular have been really receptive to this, just because they know like Netflix is a big buyer of documentaries.
That is firing so many questions in my brain right now, because like people complain about, or I've heard people complain about, like, oh, it looks like a streaming movie versus looking like a you know, a theater or big screen movie. Maybe that has something to do with it. And I was just thinking too, like, there were people, like, when I talked to Rance Collins on this podcast about the movie Mank, and we were like, why would you not just shoot it and film? Maybe that has something to do with the answer, because he can make that in digital. You think that has...
Well, I think there are two things there. One is the way David Fincher shoots. If you know you're going to be doing potentially 50, 60 takes, it becomes an economics thing where it's just cheaper and easier to shoot digitally. But yeah, I'm sure that was a consideration. What's his name?
Alfonso Cuarón. That's who I was thinking of next with Roma, because that's another one that was made for Netflix and was also...
No, I was thinking of, I think it's Eddie Mueller. I think The film critic. So he's talked about, so he does a lot of stuff with like film noir, and he programs like a whole film noir thing for TCM. And he's just sort of talked about sort of like in the process of doing restorations and then airing them on TCM, sometimes people will like complain about the way these old films look, like this, they'll say that it looks cheap. And what it is, like, I'm sort of paraphrasing this. There's another podcast, they interviewed him, he talked about this. It's called The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. But he talks about how, you know, the way those technicians and the craftspeople worked was they knew how it was going to be projected and they knew how it was going to look. And so, like, the idea is kind of like old films where the sets are built out of like plywood and duct tape or whatever were never meant to be seen in high definition home theaters. And so, like, if you have your TV set to sort of show all the details and you watch something that was sort of made that way, screen it that way, you're going to see stuff that they never intended for you to see.
Might have to be a worse experience to have it in higher definition in a way.
Yeah. I feel like you could have a whole other broader conversation about just like screening experiences, technical specs, masking, you know, is a thing. You know, sometimes you'll see a film and you'll see like the boom mic and you'll think like, oh, what are these people are doing? They're so unprofessional. But no, it's like really it was shot for a different aspect ratio and whoever is projecting it did not put the proper mask on it, you know, to like conceal things that were never meant to be seen. So
wow, so interesting. Totally quite a tangent that we've got off on. I really am fascinated by it, and yeah, I'm definitely gonna check out some of these podcasts you're talking about. Wow. Well, I suppose we should actually talk about the movie itself a little bit more now that we've talked about so much context, because this movie is so rich with those kind of Wong Kar-wai touches that we've talked about, like looking at time and use of music and all kinds of things. I took a bunch of notes. We won't go through all of them, just because we've talked a long time already. But I like to dig into the actual movie, Chungking Express, and there's so much going on here. I guess let's start with the music. So I think it's kind of a recurring thing to have jukeboxes in his films, in Wong Kar-wai's films. And there are a couple in this one, kind of really memorable moments. And we talked about dancing and how that's such a big deal in the previous one. And there's a great, like, dancing in front of the jukebox moment in this nightclub. But then, yeah, the songs that are we already referenced, but are played and played and played, that end up having, you know, a great weight as to like telling us things about these characters, which is so interesting. So there's California Dreaming. There's the one, I'm blanking on the name right now, that Faye Wong is actually singing a cover version of. What's that called?
Dreams. Yes, by the Cranberries. So,
yes, the Cranberries. Then there's What a Difference a Day Makes, plays a lot, and that totally gets at, you know, the whole idea of time and memory and all those things. Like, that, just the lyrics of that song have a lot of weight there too, which is kind of cool.
And it's then, also, go ahead.
No, there's one more song and I just couldn't remember the name, but go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, it's also fortuitous just in that, I guess like that was a song that was used in a Pan Am commercial. Mm-hmm. And so there's this element of like sort of Wong Kar Wai digging into his own past and his own memory, mm-hmm. and sort of repurposing that for this film. And so, yeah, it's just very fortunate that it had so resonant with the themes and the plot of the film itself.
Yes. Yeah. And we kind of already talked about the music being repeated, I guess, but I'm blanking on one of the songs.
The reggae song.
Yes. Things in Life by Dennis Brown. And then there's that electronic violin piece called Baroque, which that song, I think that probably the first time I watched it, my first experience of that song Baroque is it feels dated in a way. Mm-hmm. And that's actually another thing that I don't know, but like after I got over myself with that, I'm like, I actually really like this song. It kind of really fits the mood here. That's something that White Rambouille from Slash Film also said. She made a comment about how it's kind of a Gen X movie, she said something like it's a Gen X masterpiece or something like that. And I think that kind of, to me, what I heard when she said that was like the motion blur and like that song and the fact that they all have beepers all the time, like they feel of a different generation in a way, but they all feel really cool in a way too, which I don't know, that's my take on that. But yeah, the music is really, really well done and a huge interesting part of this movie.
Yeah, I think there's an element to which films can be sort of documents of a time and place, mm-hmm. and which is one of the reasons why I think it's always worth thinking about whether or not a film is a period piece or if it is contemporary, or if, you know, if someone is like willing to hold a candle up or a light up to sort of things that are happening now. And I think this is like a good document of Hong Kong at this time in 1993, mm-hmm. you know, with like the music, like all the American culture that is sort of in there with the Circle K.
Yeah.
And is there like a McDonald's in there somewhere? I think
I'm not sure if that was on one of the deleted scenes, but I remember a shot there of him eating a Big Mac. And I was like, I don't remember that in the movie, but yeah.
Doyle and Wong Kar-wai have also talked about sort of like with like the green tinting and the neon lights and things, and how like people will say that they created this look, but they will say like they were just documenting what Hong Kong was like at the time. Mm-hmm. And I think that is interesting. Just had to like have something you can look back to and say like, this is what it was like at this point in time. This is what people were doing, and everybody did have pagers, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's a major plot point in one moment here. It's like, I'm going to not take my pager cause I'm not going to get a page. And then he gets a page. And that's one of those kind of serendipitous things that happens too. So that character in particular is so obsessed with, and that's Cop 223, I think, so obsessed with expiration dates, which is such a great, kind of Wong Kar-wai touch of looking at time and how time passes and memory and all of that. There's like all these shots of a clock changing that comes in multiple times. So I can recap this, but he's been dumped by a woman named May, and it was on April 1st. And so he thinks maybe does he say something about it being an April Fool's joke? Is that something?
Yeah. Yeah. He thought it would be an April Fool's joke, and that would take a month for the joke to, I guess, pay off.
So then he gets all these dates of pineapple with the expiration dates for each day, up till May 1st. And, then he eats them all at once at that one scene. But then there's so much about expiration dates and kind of the ending of that as a moment I really love, where he goes for this run. He talks about how he loves to go jogging, and then as he's jogging, you know, it's almost his birthday, and he says, you know, actually I was born at 6 a.m. or whatever, so like the day before his birthday. Anyway, he knows the exact moment that says like, now I'm 25 years old. And then he gets that page, And then he's hit the line in the voiceovers. If memories could be canned, would they also have expiration dates? Mm-hmm. And I really love that. And then it freeze frames on him. And it's like holding on, trying to hold on to this memory of how he felt when he got that message. And like, that was a big thing in his life. You can tell it's going to like help him kind of grow and get over May that has left him. But anyway, I really love that whole aspect of it.
Yeah, this is also why I think like the 10,000 years password is more resonant and makes more sense than the undying love. And I'm not.
That's right. Doesn't he say? Go ahead.
I was going to say, I don't speak Mandarin or Cantonese, so I don't know which is the more accurate translation. But the 10,000 years just makes more sense thematically with the film.
And because I think in that moment he says, "Would they also have expiration dates?" I hope they last 10,000 years or something like that. And so that would like be a parallel moment there too. I could double check and make sure that's the actual text, but I think it says something about that length of time. There's the way time passes is really interesting. So there's a lot of kind of rhythms and rituals of life. Like we're going to the same shops every night and getting the same orders, or when he decides to change those food orders up, there's a whole bunch of stuff about food too, which is interesting. But, there's also some moments where it just like, it suddenly you realize, oh, it's a different day, but like we're all in the same place again. And you can only tell because of Faye changing shirts like in different days, because he's always wearing his cop uniform. And there's just a couple of moments I was like, oh, it's another day now, but here they all are again. Then this is another recurring thing too, is this shot of there's like I think there's two or three in the movie where something in the foreground is happening in slow motion and the background is moving very quickly. And there's a name for that. I can't remember the name.
So in the first portion of the film, it's a process that I think they used on As Tears Go By.
Yeah, I remember.
Which is, it's a different process. I know the second portion, the two scenes, it's a process called step printing where, I guess like, so like in the coffee scene, Faye Wong is just being very still. Tony Long is drinking his coffee as slowly as possible, or lifting his arm as slowly as possible. And then when you actually print the film, you duplicate those frames, I think maybe 6 or 8 times to extend the length of it.
Oh, I see.
And it creates that effect.
Interesting. And then, so the other one is where he's putting a coin in the jukebox and you can kind of, as I examined it the second time watching, it's like, okay, I think he's just moving his arm really slow and they are then, speeding up the back there. But yeah, it's a really quite an interesting visual feeling of, and there's the thing in, Days of Being Wild too, where they talk about, it's just a minute long or something, like someone says something about it, it'll just be a minute, and they're like, a minute could change your whole life, you know, a lot can happen in a minute. So just kind of getting at the idea of this, even a short period of time can be really, really significant. And so like he's just putting a coin in the jukebox, but I think at this moment going through his head is that like he's been stood up for this date and like he's going through a lot, and so like this moment is really significant to him, even though it's a really short throwaway moment.
Yeah.
There's so much about location too that I really like. Like we talked about all the locations that recur over and over in this movie, but like especially the restaurant, the Midnight Express, we're there so much, and it's we see it in different contexts and different things too. Like we're finally there in the daytime at one point, and it's like kind of jarring to see it in the daytime. It's also, so once we have the switch from the first story to the second, we've seen cop 223 at this shop multiple times. Like he checks his voicemail there and he knows the manager, and like that's, he's very familiar there. And then when we see cop 663 in the second half, and it's like, oh, he's apparently also a regular. It's just really jarring that we see him, at least it was to me, like the manager like knows him really well and is like talking very familiarly with him. And it's like, oh, he's like apparently been around and we just haven't seen him. And that just kind of freaked me out in a good way. Like I thought it was a cool kind of way to move to that other context of this new story.
Yeah. There's a way where, like Faye Wong and Tony Long's character, and I think also like Tony Long's stewardess ex, all sort of have very brief appearances in the first story.
Yes.
Yeah. That I guess originally it was intended that there would be more of a connection made between the two, but I guess it just ran out of time with the actor schedules. I think the shop owner, if I'm not mistaken, was the on-set photographer.
Yes, that's what he said in the commentary. Yeah.
Yeah.
And which so, is like, so interesting. He was like not an actor and he pulled him in to do this role.
Right. Which is also why he's not in any of the behind the scenes photography of the movie.
So he was taking the photos. Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. So I read in one of these articles that there's those connections and I was like, I'm not going to take the time to go back and look at it. But then I was rewatching it with commentary. So I kind of perked up and looked at it. So there's three moments where the characters show up. One is the stewardess is getting a taxi outside the airport when Bridget Lynn walks by. And then Bridget Lynn also is in front of a shop where Fei Wong comes out holding the teddy bear. And then we just see a shot too of Cop 2, 663, Tony Leung having his coffee up on a ledge in the first half. And it, like the first time you watch this, you'll have no idea who they are, of course, but then realize that they all connect there. Mm. I almost wondered if they could be happening, if these two stories could be happening at the same time. But I think that's probably not the case just because of where he runs into Fei, Cop 223 runs into Fei, or like they're 0.1 centimeter apart or whatever in that moment. And then it becomes her story. So I guess it does all happen kind of in sequence.
Yeah, I think like part of me wants it, them to happen concurrently, but I guess it just doesn't fit.
Yeah, it doesn't quite fit. Yeah.
Also, like the first story, doesn't the first story take place over the course of like a couple of hours or like 57 hours, right?
Yeah.
It opens, he says it's 57 hours until his birthday. And the second story goes for several days.
Yeah, that's true. Yes. Yep, yep. Well, that kind of, speaking about those moments, those freeze frame moments where it's, you know, this is the closest we ever got. Those, all the connections, kind of serendipitous moments, this kind of feeling of ennui, it's kind of all connected for me, like that, the sense of just, I guess ennui is the word for it. It's not exactly like boredom, I guess, but I guess that's how you translate the word ennui to English, but it's not quite the same. But anyway, just thinking about all the ways the two stories connect, but then like, as we've talked in the previous films, like there's so many missed connections between characters here. Obviously, both of the cops are going through breakups, and then you just don't quite get the connections that you might expect. So Cop 223 and Bridget Lynn's character connect finally and go to this hotel room, but then nothing happens and she falls asleep. And but that ends up, you know, being a huge catalyst for his growth, like the fact that nothing happens and this kind of strange. That's kind of the ennui feeling, I guess, is like what a strange evening he's had where he just stays up all night watching TV and she's just asleep on the bed. Like what a weird experience, but it kind of gets at this sense of like, this is a significant night in his life. And he has I love the line. I watched two old movies on TV that night and had four chef salads.
Crack up. Right. Yeah. The recurring theme of the chef's salads. And also there's a nice parallel where, he cleans her shoes with his tie. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then in the second story, Tony Leung gives Fei Wong a leg massage when she is at his apartment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's all those fun connections like the food. And then he eats sardines in a can. Of course, we see all the canned pineapple in the first one. And then there's some other, there's at least one other food connection I'm forgetting right now. But those are kind of the fun things to watch for as you watch this movie, is those little things that, again, like serendipitously or the same between these two movies. And then there's like that opening line, or one of the opening line in that opening narration is about the strangers around you and how like we're around strangers all the time, but they could become your friends. And like the kind of, again, kind of these young people in Hong Kong just like looking to connect with other people, and it doesn't always work out. But that's kind of like what these movies are about so far, is like that desire for connection. And then, of course, there's a whole like misconnection thing too, where she's a criminal and he's a cop, and like, and if you look at it objectively, like he should arrest her, right? Because she just killed somebody. But yeah. But yet they're having this like special night together, which is just such a funny, weird thing. And then, of course, we have Tony Leung and Fei Wong missing each other, or almost connecting, like as she's in his apartment all the time, and like he can almost sense that. It reminds me of, in Days of Being Wild, there was like two characters that met and they did not know that they had a mutual friend, but they kind of felt a weird connection for some reason. It's mm-hmm. that kind of like he can tell something's off, but he can't quite place what it is. Like, of course, she's changing things all around the apartment. Like, it should be obvious to him in a sense. Like, she changes out his giant stuffed animal to a different stuffed animal, and he like
doesn't talks to it.
Yeah,
he's like, you've changed. You've got these scars,
which I think is easy to say. Like, how would he not know? But then at the same time, I think there's probably things in my life that, like, if you completely change it, I would be oblivious to, you know, in a way that someone might be like, really? About. So, like, I can't, like, fault him for that, I guess. But, yeah, that just the whole, and like, there's one scene where she's, or a couple scenes actually, but the first time I think where she's actually there and he talks to the locker as if his ex is in there because she used to hide in there and, like, doesn't know she's actually in there. And, like, they're literally in the same space and she's hiding. But then, of course, later when, like, he discovers her and she's running away and hiding and stuff. But yeah, I just really love all those apartment scenes where she's snuck in there and how that all plays out.
We see a recurrence of Faye Wong's physical comedy ability again in the apartment. Yeah. And when she hides and sneaks out.
Yeah, that is really funny. And then too, when she first sees the stewardess, I think the only time she sees the stewardess at when she comes to bring the letter to the Midnight Express, and like the stewardess has her back to her, and the way she like stops and checks her out and is like really, really interested in her is really funny. And just like there's no dialogue at all. It's all in her physical, the way she's moving and stuff is really funny. And yeah, I wanted to, so speaking of like her physical comedy, just the physicality and all of this, we mentioned the dancing already. Yeah, a lot of Faye Wong's scenes where it's like just her with no dialogue, where she's singing and dancing and like flying the toy airplane around the apartment and that kind of thing. But then there's a montage in the middle of this that's really amazing, and it's just Tony Leung's kind of relationship with the stewardess, and kind of I think over like 2 minutes it kind of recaps the whole thing. It's incredibly sexy and it's incredibly beautifully shot, and the camera's kind of moving around, and there's the planes, the toy planes he has around, and the voiceover is talking about, it's making all these kind of puns almost about relationships and airplanes, and like, and then at the end he has to, you know, clear the runway for his next romantic interest. And all that really worked well for me, and that montage was really incredible. Oh, and there's actually on the Criterion Channel, there's a short interview with Barry Jenkins and his reaction to this movie. Yeah. And he talks about that scene in particular too. And he has some interesting thoughts on it.
Anyway. Yeah. What does he say about, I watched it
with that scene. I think he says he watched it. It was one of the first like international films he ever watched. And he was blown away by that scene in particular. Just saying that, you know, it's amazing how he captured a whole relationship in this short little montage.
Right.
And I think he talked about the camera placement and stuff as well in that scene. But yeah, I'm a big fan of Barry Jenkins, so I like his little thing on there. He also has a cool little interview on I think there's probably more, but E2 Mama Tambien, he has one on that movie that I really liked as well. Well, yeah, we can just kind of start winding down. We're talking a long time about this movie, but I did want to say that some of the visual elements, which we see the motion blur in previous films, and that comes in here as well. And then there's a lot of cool shots where people are like framed in between, like maybe a lot of the frame is black and there's just like they're in a doorway, or they're kind of in between the shelves or something like that. And there's one in particular where Tony Leung has just come to the Midnight Express the first time we've seen him there. And I think it's Faye's first day, or she's just started working there, and they've had a brief interaction, but then he like peeks in between the shelves and he can just barely see her in the back of the restaurant, but she's like dancing and like being her cute self. And you can tell he's just really enamored even in that first little shot. But I love that little, like, he can just barely see her, but you can like he's obsessed with like, what's she doing back there? That's a really cool shot.
Yeah. I guess there's like this mutual fascination between the two, because like in the first shots of Tony Leung, that's all from her POV, and so she's sort of watching him, and so like that is when her fascination with him is birthed.
Yeah, and like multiple POV that gets to at the narration, which we've kind of noted in previous films too, but you might not expect the narration to jump from character to character, but it does. I think all at least three of the four major actors here have their own narration lines, and so yeah, we really get different perspectives throughout the course of the movie. Well, Chungking Express, quite a film. I think that's it warrants a long discussion because it really is an amazing movie. And it's become one of my favorites. It's my favorite that we've watched so far in this set. Of course, I'm 3 for 3 now. Like I haven't seen any of the others yet. So we will see as we keep going. But yeah, any last thoughts on Chungking Express?
I guess I would say to people who are, well, I guess if you're listening to this podcast, you're going to have to seek it out, right? Like it's like a staple of like 90s art house cinema. Yeah. It defined a generation. I'm sort of interested. I know after this and after Fallen Angels, Wong Kar-wai said that he had to like reinvent himself stylistically. Mm-hmm. So it'll be interesting to talk about that as we move forward. But yeah, like I don't know. It's hard to overstate sort of like how influential visually this film was.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting too. I'd love to look at like some of the films that came after and kind of try to draw some of those parallels or see if someone's written that blog post, you know, that's kind of pointing towards that. But yeah, everything I've read, it says that like there's so many copycats or just similar feeling action films that came and that sort of thing. Well, that is Chungking Express. Check it out on Criterion Disc or on the Criterion channel. We're both big fans. And so check it out. Absolutely. Amaya, do you have like a, is this your favorite Wong Kar-wai? Do you know what your favorite Wong Kar-wai film is? Or do you have any sort of ranking in mind? I don't, ranking is maybe the same thing to do, but.
I don't rank things, but I do have favorites. And my favorite right now is in the Mood for Love. I think it has been since I saw it. I'll finish this thought before. Although I have not seen Happy Together, and I am interested to revisit 2046. Mm-hmm. But I will say, over the past month, the one scene that will not leave my head is Tony Leung at the end of Days of Being Wild.
So interesting. And actually, so again, we're talking more when I'm trying to wrap this up, but in the commentary, he talked about that a little bit more. So we talked about like that was intended to be two films, but I didn't quite realize, or maybe we touched on this, but it didn't connect with me, but like there was contractually reasons that Tony Leung had to appear in the first one. And so that's part of their explanation for that strange coda, is that like they had sold this movie as a Tony Leung movie, and then they ended up not having funds for what they wanted to do with his character for the second part. So like later.
I think it was something like he had a deal with a production company to appear in a certain number of films, and that sort of tied that up. And I think that's also an issue with Chungking Express, because I think like he had a contract with someone to produce a certain number of films, and this fulfilled that obligation. Mm. And then I can't remember if it was with Chungking Express or with the next film that he founded Jet Tone Films, which is his own production company, Wong Kar-wai's production company. And then he started to take more control over that aspect.
Very interesting. And so for next time, we're going to be looking at Fallen Angels, which another thing we could mention with this is that this film has two stories. Chungking Express has kind of basically two stories put together. He did conceive of a third that ended up spinning off into what became Fallen Angels. So we'll talk more about that, I'm sure, next time. But that's what I'm looking forward to in the next episode, is digging into that one, which I know very little about, actually. So basically, I'm in the dark. I knew a little bit about the two previous films. I knew I'd seen Chungking Express. I know a little bit about In the Mood for Love. But otherwise, I'm kind of going in mostly blind to these others. I know a little bit of like Happy Together's about and that kind of thing. But anyway, I'm excited to dig into them.
Great.
Well, thank you so much, Amaya. As always, always wonderful to have you here to discuss these. Could not do it without you.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Amaya. Talk to you next time. Thank you, as always, Amaya. I could not tackle these films alone, and I couldn't imagine a better guest to help break these films down. Stay tuned to your podcast app. Next time, we will look at the next film in the Wong Kar-wai box set, Fallen Angels. And I'm planning to review the new film, Annette, from director Leos Carax and starring Adam Driver and Marion Cotillard. I'm very excited for that film, which will stream on Amazon Prime on August 20th. It looks real weird, and I can't wait to check it out. And with that, thank you so much for listening to Arthouse Garage. We've got a few years worth of episodes now. You can hear them all in your podcast app of choice. Our theme music is by composer Paul Hunefeld. You can learn more at appallingproductions.com. If you want to support Arthouse Garage, leave a rating or review in your podcast app, or you can buy an Arthouse Garage t-shirt at arthousegarage.com/shop. Stay in the loop about Arthouse Garage and the films we're covering by subscribing to our email newsletter. That's at arthousegarage.com/subscribe, or you can email me directly, Andrew@arthousegarage.com. And of course, follow on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd. Just search at Arthouse Garage in all those places, or find links in the show notes. And that will do it for this episode. Thank you again so much for listening. And until next time, keep it snob free.